kilobytes. And keep going with all the units. So a kilobyte is 1,000 bytes. A megabyte is 1,024 kilobytes. A gigabyte is 1,024 megabytes. So each time you go down the row, like a terabyte, you multiply the previous unit by 1,024. Petabyte, 1,024 terabyte. An exabyte is 1,024 petabyte. A zettabyte is 1,024 exabyte. And finally, a yottabyte is 1,024 zettabyte. You may wonder why the factor being used is 1,024 and not 1,000 that we're used to see in the metric system. So let's say that you want to build a 1 kilobyte memory chip. So the first thing you will need is some control, like do you want to write to the chip? Do you want to read the chip and write to a specific address with specific data? So you will need, since it's byte that you want, you will need 8 data lines for the data that you want to write. After that, you will need to address that specific memory location that where you want to either read or write. And to do that, the memory chip will need address line. And the formula is 2 to the power of the number of address pin that you're going to put on the chip. So if we put 10 address line, you get 2 to the power of 10. And if you use your calculator to do that, you get the 1,024. So this is why for computers, when we say kilobyte, it's 1,024 and not 1,000. And you get 10 address line. If you try it only with 9, you get 512. So this is why they use, for 1,024, they need 10 lines. Let's say that you have a few billions dollars. What would you need to store and process a zettabyte of data? You will need a facility, something like this. This is the National Security Agency. And the whistleblower, William Binet, has put the capacity of that data center to 5 zettabytes. So if you recall the table on the previous slide, it was the last second row of storage. Just to give you a size, it's not something you can build in your backyard. This is a car or a truck. So look at the size of that facility. It's big. These two buildings there are the chiller to cool the data center. The next set of 4 buildings are the power supply or the power generator, the generation for the data center. And these two buildings here are the actual data center. So to store a zettabyte, you need a lot of things and it costs a lot of money. Now, if we go back to more regular thing, in your computer, you can have an internal storage. And most of the time, it's an hard drive or hard disk drive. And they look something like this. And if you open the case, which you should not do because you will void the warranty, but if you do that, it will look something like this. So you can see the actual hard disk. This is why they're calling that type of drive hard disk drive. And there's a small arm, which we don't see on that picture, but that has a disk spin that small arm move with the reading head or the writing head on it to go and read or write data as you ask for information from the hard drive. Obviously, the faster the drive spin, the faster you will get your data. So this is why if you have a choice between 2 hard drives, pick one that has the speed that go, the rotation speed is higher. The next type of internal storage that you can get is the solid state drive. You know, that kind of you will see use SSD. And these look like this. They look like basically a memory chip. So on it, you will see the company that made it and the size. And if you do open it, it will look like this, basically a bunch of memory chips. So there is no moving parts. So these are way like 1,000 times faster, maybe more than the previous type of hard drive. And they are different than the memory chip that you have in your computer. So the memory chip in your computer, as soon as you turn the power off, the information is forgotten. These are special memory chips that will keep the information. Now, if we move on to removable storage, we have many types, and you probably have seen all of them. The first one is a CD or DVD or Blu-ray drive and drives and disk. You can get your memory card reader and memory card. So this is the type of memory card that you use, for example, in a digital camera. So if you want to, you can get the memory card or the camera and put it in that so you can read it as a, it will appear as a drive in your File Explorer. The USB memory stick or keys, and they come in all shape and form. If you want something bigger, you can go with USB portable external hard drive. So these ones fit in your hand, and they, I've seen them go up to 2 terabytes, even 4. But if you need something bigger, you need to get something like this. And this is a large capacity drive. On the on that photo, it, this is a 12 terabyte disk, and it's fairly big, 16 centimeter tall, and you need a power, an external power supply. The USB portable, most of the time, they don't need an external power supply. They get their power that they need from the USB connector. So now that we understand all of these type of storage, if we move to a cloud storage, what does it look like? So let's look at the diagram. So you have your computer at home that has your internal or and removable storage, but it is located at your location, basically, most likely in your house. You can get cloud storage, but that cloud storage is stored in the cloud storage provider, most likely in a data center somewhere on the planet Earth. And how do you access that cloud storage? It's through the internet. And by doing that, it gives you a number of advantage and disadvantage, and we'll cover that. I will cover that in the next slides. The first thing, what this allows you to do is now your data is not only accessible to you from many devices, as long as you have access to the cloud or the internet, you can reach that cloud storage. And if you have the proper credential, i.e. the password, access the information, you can. So you can get it from your Windows PC, your laptop, your PDA, your cell phone, et cetera, all of these devices. But not only you, other people that you give access to your cloud storage can get access. So if you need to store, you want to store documents or work together as a team on a document, you can do that with cloud storage. So it gives you a lot of flexibilities. So if we look at the advantage of cloud storage, first one is cost. So if you purchase physical storage, can become expensive. When you use cloud storage, you don't need to buy them. And it's what I've read in my research on that is cheaper per gigabyte than using external hard drive. Accessibility. As long that you have access to internet, basically, you can get access to your file. Recovery. So in the event that your hard drive that is located internal to your desktop or your removable hard drive get damaged or stop malfunctioning, you can access the file that you have stored on the cloud as a backup solution and restore them to your new drive or something like that. However, is the cloud storage provider doing backup? I didn't find any information on that, and I'm not too sure if they just use a bunch of data center and the, your information is probably stored in mini physical place just to make sure that it's always available. Syncing and updating. So you can download, most of the cloud provider offer software that you can download and install that on your workstation. And as and when you do the setup of that software, you identify which file on your computer you want to be synced with the file in the cloud. And as soon as you make a change, regardless on which device or which access point you're doing a change, it can be your desktop, it can be your tablet, it can be your phone, it's going to be synced right away. In terms of security, most cloud storage provider, they provide additional layers of security to their services. There's many people accessing their data in the cloud, so they go and make sure that their stuff is secure. Sharing, ability to easily share large files with others. Like, for example, if you have a video that you want to share, most likely the email system will not want to send that file because it's too big, but you can just put it in your cloud and provide access to either all selected people or everyone that you want to get access to that. And you, the most cloud will generate a link that you can, after that, you can just send to whoever you want to have access to the files, and they can download that file directly from the cloud. But they have some disadvantage of cloud storage. The first one is you need an internet connection. If you don't have that, you're stuck. There is a way to, and also if your internet connection is really slow, uploading and downloading large file may become impractical. There is a way that you can say, I want to keep a local copy. And most of the time that setting is called offline access, and you will keep a local copy, at least allowing you to keep working while the internet connection comes back. You can also, if you use the sync function, you need to be careful what you pick. It's obvious if you pick, like you're editing a video that is a few gigabytes big, and each time you make a change, you sync it with the cloud, it will use your internet connection to do that. So in terms of costs, if you need to buy, sometimes the some cloud provider will charge you more for uploading and downloading file from their cloud. So if you're not, if you're doing a lot of accessing, it can become really expensive. I think it's only on the commercial system, because most of the free one at Epson, I have a couple of slides on that later on, they don't do that. Hard drive, cloud storage is supposed to eliminate our dependencies on hard drive, but it's not really the case. The cloud storage provider is probably buying a truckload of them. In terms of support, most cloud, they provide it, but depending, if you're getting the free version, you probably won't get a human being at the other end of the phone to help you. You'll have to rely on their knowledge base or frequently asked question or Google to find the solution to the problem that you're having. Privacy. And when you use a cloud provider, your data is no longer on your physical storage. So who is responsible to making the data is secure? In theory, it's the cloud provider. But I don't know, let's say that the cloud provider is located in China or Russia. Are you going really to trust that the government is not going to get access to your data, or they're not going to resell it to someone? So you need some information and have about the, your cloud service provider to really make sure that they will live to what they are saying about keeping your data private. So I will, in the next couple of slides, I will show you a couple of free cloud service provider. But the question is, how do they make money if they provide a free service? So a lot of these companies, what they offer is try before you buy a scheme. In cloud storage, it's called freemium. And the idea is that the user is more likely to try your product if it's free. And once the user is using the product, they will discover many additional feature and function, and they will get used to use that specific system. So if they need more storage, most likely they will be okay to pay to get access to that storage than that provide more storage than the free version. The pro, it's free. The con, file size limit. So all of them, they provide some kind of limit for their free service. After that, you need to start paying a certain amount per month. And some of them, they may, over and above the file limit, they may include the bandwidth restriction. So if we look at the most popular cloud storage provider in 2021, The first one is iCloud, and the scale on the left, or the number at the top, is the number of millions of user worldwide. So iCloud is mainly for the people using the Apple products, so 300 million. Google Drive is about 200 million people using it. Microsoft OneDrive, 250. Dropbox, 300 million. And Box, 25. So this one is not as popular as the remaining four. I put a table together that give the information about, on the left column, you can see the name like iCloud, Google Drive, etc., and what platform they are compatible with, because like I said, sometimes they offer software to sync between your desktop and the cloud, and they may not support all of the OS. Most of them do, but you can see the list there. The third column is the one that is interesting. So how much free space do you get? So for iCloud, it's 5 gigabytes. Google Drive is 15 gigabytes. Microsoft OneDrive, it's 5. Dropbox is only 2. And Box is 10 gigabytes. But as soon as you begin to exceed these free allocation, you need to start paying. So, and when I was doing the research, it was not clear if the price I was looking at, if it was in Canadian dollar or U.S. Most likely, I suspect it's probably in U.S. dollars, but it may be some of those are in Canadian dollar too. But in the case of, let's say, Google Drive, if you wanted the 15 gigabyte is no longer sufficient, you can go for 100 gigabyte for, say, $2 per month. And I put other one, like 2 terabyte for $10 per month. And there is more options. It was a very long table giving a whole lot more of options. One that I find interesting is the Microsoft OneDrive. It's if you buy the Office subscription, you get 1 terabyte of Microsoft OneDrive included. So that's a pretty good deal. In the part two, I will show how to install, how do you create a cloud storage account? How do you upload and download files using a browser? How do you share a file using a link? How do you share a folder so other one can, you can again give them full access? So now they can not only download the file, but they can upload a new version. And installing and using the sync software. So I'm still working on that deck. I should be able to present it next week. That's it.
That's it, Stefan. It won't be next week because we have a regular meeting. So
all right. Okay. 17. So the next Q&A session.
And the next one will be on the 17th. So looking forward to that. Thanks very much, Stefan. If anybody has any questions, you can unmute yourself or put comments into the chat. I have a couple of comments. One of the things that I've always told people in terms of privacy of your information, I think that if you're using cloud storage with anybody, if anything is sensitive at all, it should be encrypted before you store it in a cloud service provider, and then that eliminates your risk on that front. One of the other things when I was looking at various cloud service providers is that there could be other limits that are in place, especially on free ones, such as the ability to recover deleted items. Most of them, like Google Drive, they have where if you delete items, they'll go into a bin and you can recover them up to 30 days. After that, they're deleted permanently. So look for the terms and conditions on various things like that. Also, I found that some cloud providers such as Degoo, which will give you 100 gigabytes of free storage, but if you don't use your account in 90 days, they'll delete files on you. And so watch out for things like that. And then final comment that I had was that certainly on the paid side, there's a lot more features that you can get. One which was kind of interesting, if you actually had to recover, a couple of terabytes of information, doing it over an internet connection could be a real pain in the butt to do. And Backblaze, one of the cloud providers, you can pay a deposit. They will actually ship you hard drives, and with your data on it, you can then recover locally, which would be a lot faster, and then you ship the drives back to them, and they'll refund you your deposit on that. What are the comments we have here? So we have from Tristan, disk on the cloud provider is redundant via RAID or triple mirroring, depending on the provider. It is not by default backed up normally unless you set that up, though each one has different features. For home users, the most cost-effective is usually Backblaze. So Backblaze is actually a pretty good deal. They have some pretty good features at reasonable prices. Alan has comments, storing large number and or large files in the cloud can be problematic, as typically the upload speed of your ISP is 1/10 the download speed, so uploading data can take a long time. Now that's true for sure. Tristan, it's great as a backup for your most important data, family photos, important documents, etc. If happen to be on Amazon Prime subscription, you get unlimited photo cloud storage included. That's pretty cool. And you can even add up to 5 other family members for the free photo backup under the same subscription. That's another interesting thing about the Microsoft OneDrive. And if you have a subscription with Microsoft Office, that typically, if you go with the family plan, I think it's 6 users now, and each of those 6 users get 1 terabyte of cloud storage on OneDrive. So that can be a really, really good deal. However, it sort of locks you into that, because if you actually upload a terabyte of information there and then you decide you no longer want to pay the subscription fee for your Microsoft Office, then all of a sudden you're going to have to come up with a solution for your terabyte of files elsewhere. And we have a couple of comments about thanks and good presentation. Tom commented, encryption is the problem, how to manage. Definitely, that's with encryption, that's always an option or an obstacle or an issue you have to deal with for sure. And Bob Hares, big thank you on that. Tristan, if you have a NAS like Synology or TrueNAS, they have integrated features to back up to cloud with encryption. That's nice to know. So, yeah, I think it's really critical that you make sure that you're aware of the what the features are and what the costs are for all the different features when you do get into doing cloud storage.
I may say also, maybe another risk is that you also become dependent on the rules that those providers have. For example, Google Photo used to be, they were able to keep their photos forever, and then they decided, no, you have to access them otherwise they will disappear for a certain time. So
yeah,
you are dependent on those providers.
Yeah, of course, you can always switch to a different provider. If you find that the one you're using is onerous, then you can look around for a replacement one.
In which case, you better make sure that your files are on the cloud as a backup, not as the only copy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, keep in mind, cloud storage provider, you're really just, it's somebody else's computer is where you're storing them. And so all of the possibilities that go along with the idea that you're using somebody else's computer come into play. Okay, I think we've covered off the questions and comments in the chat and Audible. So I think, Alan, if you wanted to take us through the rest of tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris, and thanks, Stefan. That was an excellent presentation on disk storage, and I look forward to part 2, which, again, I'll just remind everyone, will be on November the 17th, the week after next, and because there's no QA with the regular meeting. Okay, so the first thing we have is a share, and I'm going to toss it right back to Chris to talk about a new power toy.
Okay, and as per usual, I'm pasting all of the URLs in the various slides into the chat window, so you don't have to madly try and type these out while the slides go by. So yeah, PowerToy, it was actually Alan who alerted me to this fact that release 0.49 came out, and they had added in a new PowerToy into the collection called Find My Mouse. And basically the way it works is that if you press the left control key twice, it'll highlight the mouse pointer, or more accurately dims the rest of the screen so that you can see where the mouse pointer is. You can press the escape key to dismiss that highlighting feature. If you move your mouse around, if you leave it steady, we press control twice and you don't touch your mouse, it'll stay on. But as soon as you move your mouse, after 2 seconds after you stop moving your mouse, the effect disappears. So you can also, as it turns out, press any other key will also dismiss the highlight. And I hope that that's a documentation problem, not a bug in the program, because the actual keystroke is passed on to whatever program has the focus. So if it has to be hitting the escape key to get rid of the effect, if you have to be presenting in PowerPoint, that'll end your slideshow. So I certainly don't want that to be the case. So I hope it continues to be any keystroke will end the effect, in which case I'll just hit the shift key or something like that. I have at the bottom of the screen the where you can get PowerToys to do the download. Yeah, I think it works really well. It seems to be very stable and so forth, but it has some limitations. You can't adjust the size of the circle. You can't adjust the opacity of the background of the screen. There's no option to reverse the effect where you have a colored circle or shaded circle or something like that around the mouse pointer and then leave the rest of the screen as its normal brightness and color and so forth. You can't disable that effect of automatic dismissal after 2 seconds. So if it disappears on you, you just have to hit the control key twice to have it come back on, but it could be a little bit distracting. If you're using Zoom, it'll only work when you're sharing full screen. On the Zoom, it doesn't work if you're sharing single apps. All of the above, I submitted them as enhancement suggestions, and I did get a reply on the Zoom issue, and I was told that that likely won't be fixed because the way Zoom works when you're sharing a single application, it is a single application being shared. And the operating system, or Zoom, sees the application that is being shared and the mouse utility as two different applications. And so it won't ever work within that mode. And that'll be the same with all of the cursor enhancing tools, except for one that I'll come to in a minute.
Tom has a comment here, Chris. In accessibility settings, you can have concentric animated circles.
Yeah,
when you press
I'm coming to that.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, so I started looking around for some alternatives to that because I saw that the limitations they have in there currently preclude my using it because I use a program called Cursor Highlighter. I talked about this in a newsletter article, and it's a really cool utility. So it's very customizable. So they have two modes. You can have either focus mode, and that's the top picture of the squirrel there, where it highlights it's the same sort of thing that you would see in the Microsoft PowerToy, in that it gives you a circle with the standard brightness and dims everything else. But even on that, you can customize it. You can set the size of the circle. You can set the opacity of the background, the color of the background, so you could have it, you know, a reddish tint to the entire background, things like that. You can also use highlight mode. And in this case, that's where I want the PowerToy to actually be able to go to, where you will optionally be able to have it where it'll do a colored circle around the mouse pointer and then leaves the rest of the screen normal. And again, you can do adjust the size of the circle, the color of the circle, the opacity of the circle. And then also you can have it that when you left or right click, it will change the color, opacity, or size. So if you're demoing something and you say, well, when it turns green, it's because I've actually clicked, or when it turns, you know, orange, it's because I right-clicked or something like that. So if you're demoing something, a technique or something, people can really tell what's going on. Now, why I think that highlight mode is so important is in the example that you see right there. This is my photo editor. and I have this picture of the squirrel. And if I'm trying to show people how to adjust the, I think in this one, the mid-tones slider, so I can go on and I can drag the slider left or right to adjust the mid-tones in the photo. If I'm in focus mode, the background is dimmed, so I can't actually see the effect as I drag the slider back and forth. But if when I'm in highlight mode, as I drag the slider back and forth, you see the location of my mouse pointer, you see it's on the mid-tone slider, and you will actually see the effect on the photograph itself. So I think it's really a very powerful use, very powerful tool for highlighting the cursor, and it's free. So if you're interested in that, take a look at the newsletter article. It tells where to get it. You have to download two programs, but they're both free. And the next one is, so another one I found is called Mouse Pointer Highlight, and it is in the Microsoft Store. It's a free app as well, and it leaves the main screen as is and highlights just the mouse pointer. So you can set the size, opacity, and the color of the circle, and optionally, you can set it so that when you're left-clicking, it'll set the size, opacity, and color differently than you want. So one of the advantages of being in the Microsoft Store that I like is that it sort of automatically installs on any computer where you're logged into your Microsoft account. It uninstalls cleanly, or as cleanly as anything can nowadays on Microsoft computers. And it's small, lightweight, so forth. Installs very easily and so forth. The disadvantages to this is it doesn't load as a background app or in the tray. The system tray. So there's no hotkey to enable or disable it. As long as the program is running, the highlight will be on. So if you want to stop the highlight, you have to close the program. And if you want the highlight back on, you have to rerun the program. So you could, pin it to your taskbar or something like that. But it is on or off depending on whether the program is actually running. The next alternative I found was Cursor Highlighter. And this was actually kind of cool, because this is a Chrome extension, so it should work in any Chromium-based browser. It will only work within the browser, but if you are doing a demo where you're just demoing something through the browser, this is a viable option for sure. The actual colored circle that you see there on the screenshot of the blue circle, it pulses up and down a little bit, so you can really highlight where you're actually pointing to at one point in time or another. You can customize the color for the circle, but you can't customize the size of the pulses that go out. One of the things that's kind of neat is that it does work over Zoom sharing just the browser windows. And it's because it's running as part of the browser process that it will actually continue to work. The disadvantage is that it does only work in the browser and only in browsers that are based on Chromium. And it doesn't seem to work for all web pages. There were some web pages where I had to reload the page after enabling it, and then there were some that it just didn't work at all. But for some people, in some certain circumstances, it might be a really nice option. So the next one is getting down into native Microsoft Windows. So the first is that you can change the size and the color of the mouse pointer by going to Settings, Devices, Mouse, Adjust Mouse, and Cursor Size. The advantage is built into Windows itself, so any computer that you go to, it'll be installed and available to you, and it does display constantly. So that, I guess, could be a disadvantage as well, but generally speaking, it's nice to have it that it's just on, always there. Disadvantage is the size that you see. If you adjust its size up, that doesn't come across on Zoom at all. So with over Zoom, the pointer will always be the default pointer size. And if you're into screen capturing, the size of the mouse cursor doesn't seem to be captured by any screen capture programs either, and it'll just capture the mouse cursor as the default size. Usually picks up the color, but just not the larger size. And I wrote an article on using that as Quick Tip 6, so you can look up that if you're interested in that. The next alternative is also built into Microsoft Windows, and that's a control panel option. So you have an option on there of show location of pointer. So if you go to Settings, Devices, Mouse Additional Options, or at that point just go to Control Panel, and then you go to the Pointer Options tab, show location of pointer when I press the control key. When you press and release the control key, you'll get a series of concentric circles that appear around the mouse cursor. The advantage is, again, built into Windows, so it's always there. It does work over Zoom sharing in either full screen or single application windows. Disadvantages, I don't find it as visible, and it's a very brief effect. Now, you can sit there, tap again and again and again on the control key, but each time you press and release it, you'll get one large circle that goes down into smaller concentric circles and then disappears. But again, might be useful for some people, depending on your use cases. And I think that was it. Oh, that's it for me. And Alan, I'll kick it over to you for talking about what the alternatives are in Linux.
Chris had suggested that a possibility for Linux, and it turns out that this capability is also built into the operating system, or at least the Linux Mint. And if you go to the system settings and mouse and touchpad, there's this toggle right here, show position of pointer when the control key is pressed. So this is a single press of the control key. Once this is enabled, it will basically tell you where the cursor is. And it's very similar to the Windows one where you get concentric circles. My problem was I couldn't do a screenshot of it because the thing basically didn't show up on the screenshot. So what I've got here is a short video, and you can see right here, as I move the mouse across into this area and then hit the control key, you can basically see the effect. And then a second time. So that's basically how the built-in one works in Linux. And I suspect that's similar to some of the concentric circles that Chris has been talking about. Okay, so moving along, we have a share from Stuart Bruce. So Stuart, do you want to talk about this? In which case you'll have to unmute your microphone.
Hello. I guess that worked. I don't have much to say except what's already on the screen, really. It's pretty simple. If anyone's got any habits of keeping their desktop computer browser clean and fresh, well, the same thing works on Android. Saves space, and probably more space than it does on your desktop. Your browser sucks up your history, and it remembers everything, and it does it on desktop and Android, and I never realized because, you know, I'm a little slow. Things just don't sink in as fast as they did 40, 50 years ago. So an article said, clean your history on your browser, on your phone. I said, oh, geez, I've got three browsers on my phone. I better start digging.
And just a note here, Stuart, Sam Mobile, which I didn't realize, is actually a kind of a user forum for Samsung phones and tablets.
Yes, it's sammobile.com, I think, is a website. It's sourced in the Netherlands, and it's a Samsung fan. Well, you know, it's all about Samsung. Everything and anything Samsung. Yeehaw. It's also an excellent source of firmware for your phone if it's out of date. You're not getting it. I may be talking about that in the future a little bit because, software updates on phones is expletive deleted. Anywho, that's the website that pointed me at the idea of paying attention to my mobile browser and the history and the amount of information stored in it. And as I said, I have no idea how much I managed to clean up, but I have three different browsers for three different reasons. And I went through them all, and you basically have to just hit the settings and find history and what is stored there, very much like you do with your desktop browsers. And Alan's email told me he managed to save 109 megabytes. And on, well, he's got this ancient old G4.
G3.
God. Third in the third century. Anyway, that's a lot on an older phone, and even my phone is ending its software update life cycle, but every megabyte counts on these things, unless you send everything to the cloud. But that's another story too. Anywho. In a diverse way of getting to it, go into your mobile browser on your phone, look at the settings, look at the history, and look at how to clean it out. Cookies, cache, and all that stuff.
Okay, thanks. Thanks very much. That is a very useful tip. I haven't cleaned out my browser stuff for a long time either, so. It can be worthwhile. Okay, so the next item on the agenda is that I have a share. This is the Ottawa Public Library website, and I've talked about the possibility of reading computer magazines, basically online magazines like PC Magazine, PC World, that kind of thing. But they also have ebooks available, and Bob Walker's talked a lot about reading ebooks. I've been reading ebooks using my hybrid tablet for quite a bit. And one of the things I do is I tend to look at series. One of the problems is you start reading the series and then all of a sudden you'll come across one that isn't available in the library, and either they've lost it or somebody's lost it for them or something, but you're basically missing out on an item in the list that you're trying to read. And the problem is some of these things are kind of serial in that one book follows after the next. They're not always completely standalone. So, and sure enough, if you try and search for this particular novel on the Ottawa Public Library website, you'll find that it doesn't exist anymore. And nothing is found. But when I was playing around, I think with the Libby app, I found that the library actually partners with four other libraries in Ontario, Hamilton, London, Burlington, and Mississauga, so that with an Ottawa library card, you can actually loan books from these four libraries. Even better than that, if you go to the Overdrive website, and this is overdrive.com, and you click on the search icon here, you can put in the name of the book that you're looking for, and then it has this thing called Find a Library. So I, in my innocence, I thought, well, you know, they're partnering with London, so I'll look for London. So I click on that, and I enter London, and it gives me this map, and there's Grand Bend on the lake, and London's buried in there somewhere. Well, you can use the plus and minus sign to make this thing bigger, or you can just scroll down here, and you will get a list of libraries. These are branches. And here's the main. I used to live in London, so I happen to know that the main library is on Dundas Street. So this is the main branch. But basically, they're all linked to the same online database. So we can look in the database here. And then it's like going on to the Ottawa Public Library website and searching for a book. But there's a better way than that. The better way is to put in what you want and then just search for it on overdrive.com. So you hit the search icon here and it goes away and it says, well, I've got this book And I've also got an audio version of it. And if you click on the book, I want the ebook. So if I click on the ebook, it tells me where this book is found in various libraries. Now, it can't find it in Ottawa because we know it doesn't exist in the Ottawa Library. But you notice that it says it's available in the Ottawa Hamilton and the Ottawa London. So clearly it knows I'm based in Ottawa, but it also knows that Ottawa is linked to these other libraries. So I like London because I used to live there. So if I click on view on the library site, then it pulls up. And you notice that I'm not actually on the London Public Library website. I'm on a page which belongs to that library on overdrive.com. And because I have an account with overdrive.com, I can simply say place a hold. Now it takes me to the credentials. So it wants my Ottawa Public Library card number and PIN. So if I put those two variables in, then it brings up the book I'm looking for, and basically I can say place a hold, and now I'm number one on one copy. So that is basically going to be available to me almost immediately. So that's a really useful way if you're missing a book in the Ottawa Public Library, and you can find it in one of these other partnering branches or libraries. It's a really useful way to find it. And the other thing it's helpful for is if there's a long list of people in Ottawa who have already signed up, have already put the book on hold, so you're number 36 on three copies, and take a look at one of the other branches, because it may be that nobody's following that series and the book is instantly available somewhere else. It can be a very useful technique. Okay. I don't see any questions in the chat, so I'll move on to the next share.
Okay, we do have a question. How do you keep track of what you want to read next?
My LibreOffice writer file, which had all the titles and what I've seen, and I can basically go down there and pick out what I want to try for next.
Okay. Okay, the next share I have is for new IPTC tags for accessibility. There's in digital photos, there's two ways that information can be embedded into the file itself. And one is EXIF information, which is basically camera information. So it'll give you the make, model, the lens, the focal length, the exposure, aperture, shutter speed, ISO, so forth. There's also IPTC tags that can be embedded into the digital file. And this is more about the person who took the picture or things like that. So you can see the tags in the screenshot there. You have the person's name, their website, copyright information, things like that. Well, IPTC has just added or is adding this month two new tags, alt text and extended description, for accessibility purposes. And this is kind of neat because while web authors, when they're putting up images on their web pages, they can put an alt text tag in there, but it doesn't actually travel with the photo. If you grab the photo and you upload it somewhere else and put it on a website, you don't automatically get that that tag. Well, with these new tags, if people actually start using them, it'll be embedded in the actual photo. And as the web browsers start looking for those particular tags, you'll be able to get this information automatically when you hover the mouse over top of an image. And so it'll be more the photographers or the photo editors that'll be in control of the information that you see if you hover your mouse over top of a photo. And screen readers will be able to read that information as well. So I think this is a big step ahead for accessibility and for anybody in using screen readers in particular. So just an interesting factoid that came out. We'll probably see more and more of that in the coming months and years ahead.
Tom's asking, does file type matter, PNG, for example?
Anything that supports IPTC tags should have it, but I don't know what file formats actually do support IPTC tags. Certainly JPEGs do. I don't know what other file formats do.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So I have another version of my abandoning the Windows ship, looking for alternatives to Linux programs. And so far we've looked at some stuff. And today I guess we're going to look at disk image backup. So I use a Windows program. I use Macrium Reflect to make full disk image backups. That clearly is a Windows program. There's no Linux version available for that. So what am I going to do? One of the things I can do is basically just search for Linux alternatives to Windows programs, and it pulls up this website called Alternative 2, which is very general. It's just looking for alternatives to specific programs, not necessarily operating systems. But if I go to that website and I type in Macrium Reflect, it tells me that they've got 74 alternatives. So if I look at the alternatives, and there's a whole raft of things here, and the first one on the list is Clonezilla. And I've used Clonezilla before. It's an open source program. It's available for Linux. There's also a Windows version, for what it's worth. But I'm interested in the Linux version. And if I go to the website, then it will tell me all about Clonezilla. But for our purposes, we'll just look at the highlights. So one of the things is Clonezilla supports a lot of different file systems. So EXT4, which is a Linux file system, and FAT16, which is a DOS-based thing, or usually for USB keys, USB flash drives, and also NTFS for Windows partitions. Along with most backup systems, it only backs up the use block, so it's space efficient. It supports both MBR and GPT partitioning. And the image file can be saved to a local disk, which is what I would do, an external USB hard drive, or a server if you have a local area network. You can encrypt it. I never bother encrypting it with a high-level encryption system. You can save and restore entire disks or individual partitions, which is very useful. I often will restore just the Linux partition because I've screwed something up, but the Windows thing is fine. I don't need to do anything with it. When you're recovering, the destination partition has to be the same size or bigger than the source. It doesn't like squeezing big partitions into small partitions, which is quite reasonable. Chris will be upset because right now it doesn't do incremental backups. It doesn't do differential or incremental, but it says yet. So clearly they're working on this. And the other downside is that unlike Macrium Reflect, for example, you can't mount the image and then browse it in a file explorer and pick out individual files or folders to copy to somewhere else. But there are workarounds for that, but they're not very user-friendly. So that is certainly a possibility. However, there's another interesting possibility is you recall that when you have a disk imaging program, you should really build a rescue disk so that you can boot from a live USB, for example, run the software and recover your backup image from your external USB and write it to your brand new or broken hard drive. So you can restore your system very quickly. So rather than do that, you boot into the rescue disk, and then rather than use the restore tab, you actually use the backup tab. It's basically a fully functional version of Macrium Reflect, albeit running on a small version of Windows, Windows PE, for example. And now you can back up the hard drive or a partition just normally and save it to a USB drive. So I'm basically using a Windows-based USB drive to back up my system for use on a Linux box. So
you just can't drag you away completely from Windows there, Alan.
Well, if I use Clonezilla, I could, but this is a neat way. I actually like Macrium Reflect. It works really well. It has a much nicer user interface than Clonezilla, So this is not a bad option, as it turns out. So as far as I'm concerned, I can tick off disk image backups, and that's a go. So I'm going to skip, at least I hope I'm going to skip. I'm going to skip a few slides here because we don't have much time left, and I'm going to go to this one and run a, from the current slide and turn it over to Chris, who has another share.
Yeah, I came across this kind of an interesting program for, especially for anybody who is picturing out of Adobe Photoshop. And it's a free ad supported. So you do have to have a panel with some ads running on it on your web browser, but it's an online photo editor and it looks or feels almost identical to Adobe Photoshop. And you can see anybody who's used Photoshop, if you look at the screenshot there, you'll see the tool well looks identical, where you see the history and the different layer panels and things like that, virtually identical to the way that Photoshop actually works. And next slide. So the native file format is actually a PSD file, which is a Photoshop document file. It can read and export most file formats, including JPEG, RAW, Adobe Illustrator, PNG, TIFF, so forth. It doesn't have all of the Photoshop tools and capabilities. I don't know what are missing because I'm not a Photoshop user, but I did read a couple of reviews and they said there's some in-depth features that are not there, but it does have all the basics such as ability to deal with layers and blending of layers and masking and cropping of images, doing adjustment layers for things like, you know, color or, luminosity and things like that. You can do, it has healing brushes and things like that. You can do selections of parts of the image, do gradient masks, all the rest of it. So a lot of the basics are there. I think it's best for Adobe Photoshop people who are away from their main computer. And so maybe you're at a client's office or something like that, and you have to do a quick edit to a photo that you've got stored in the cloud somewhere or on a flash drive, and you can just call this up in the browser, do the edits, and away you go. Or it might be good for somebody that is just moving into the Photoshop realm, so they're on a less capable photo editor. They think they might want to go with something like Photoshop. It's going to cost you a fair amount of money to jump into that. This could be something that you could try out. It might have all of the features of Photoshop that you need in your photo editing, and you never have to pay for Photoshop at all. Or you can decide at that point that you want those extra capabilities that are only in Adobe Photoshop. So just something that everybody can try out, and looks kind of interesting.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I just have a real quick question. HP have this product called Wolf Security, which is pretty new and comes with, if you buy a brand new computer, it has an antivirus product and also a browser protection product built into it. My question is, does anybody have any experience with these things, and basically are they any better than Windows Defender and the security that's built into Windows? I posted this on the OPCUD members forum, and nobody had any particular experience with Wolf Security, although there were some general comments, which I agree with. But if anybody has any bright ideas about this, if you let me know, then that would be helpful to a friend of mine. Okay, we're really close to, well, we're over time by a couple of minutes. Anybody have any other questions outstanding?
Tom has one there. Has anybody installed pfSense firewall using Docker or on the TerraMaster NAS device? So if anybody has experience with that, you could unmute yourself or answer in the chat. I don't see any answers coming in there. Do we have any other questions before we call it a night? Okay, maybe Alan, you can continue with the wrap-up slides.
Yeah, okay. So basically, this will be next week, Monday, November the 8th. Bob Walker starts off the next session of Tech Cafe with the library with his presentation on renewable energy. And I remind you that you have to register with the library to get the login credentials for their Zoom session. On November the 10th is our regular meeting. So this will be next Wednesday. A really interesting presentation, if you read the blurb on the website, on computers and astronomy, different apps that are used for astronomical considerations, and also a special feature by Andrea here on photography. So that promises to be very interesting next week, November the 10th. And then I remind you that because it's a regular meeting, we don't have a Q&A after that meeting. So our next Q&A, get your questions ready and your shares for a week on Wednesday, which will be November the 17th. So I hope everybody's enjoyed tonight. We've had a lot of information, pretty packed agenda. So thanks to everyone who provided that. And we look forward to seeing you next week at the regular meeting and at future Q&As.
Thanks for coming, folks.
And we are out of here.